20 veterans of World War II told their life stories in 2018 as part of South Australia's contribution to the Anzac Day commemoration initiative. They enriched our collective memory accordingly. So strong has been the public response that now another 6 veterans have been interviewed, adding their voices to this exercise in oral history. And so, in 2019, we have the honour of presenting World War II in Words, Part 2. The war itself is remembered as a time of oppression and destruction, lasting 6 years and forever reshaping each society caught in its conflict. In addition, though, it fostered mateship and achievement and honour. In this second series of interviews, our 6 veterans reflect on the emergence of those qualities in that life-changing era. Their words supply an enduring record of service and survival. And so to a war widow's story, as told by Thelma Zimmerman. When war broke out, she was working in an ice cream factory. She and her boyfriend decided to get married, join up, and help win that war. For her, that meant service as a telephonist in the Women's Auxiliary Australian Air Force. Military service runs deep in her family's history. Her father, George Kinsman, was a World War I veteran, seeing action on the Western Front, and her brother, Sidney Kinsman, became a Rat of Tobruk and a prisoner of war.
100 years ago this year, my father was at the Western Front, served in the 10th Battalion, and like many, many hundreds of others, he was a digger. They had to dig their own trenches, and when it rained, the rain was still there, no way to get it out. And eventually Dad got gassed, took him by boat to England, repaired him, as the saying goes, and back into the trenches. No R&R in those days. And then another time, Dad was buried for a few hours, and his mate said, "Where is he?" So they went back and found him, found part of him, and dug him out, and he was rested for 24 hours, and then he was seen to be okay. Returned home eventually with a leaking valve of the heart, and results of the
gassing.
Yes. He was never had good health after that.
And he didn't live very long, did he?
No, sadly, Dad died at age 46, and like many of them, but at least he did come back to Mother, and we all come along after all the children.
Yes, let's go back to your early days then, Thelma. Can you tell me about where you were born and when you were born?
Well, we're a family of 12 children, 6 boys and 6 girls. Sadly, there's only 5 left now, and the 5 are in their 90s. The last one comes 90 in January, but the rest of us are all in our 90s. And we went to the Highmarsh School for our
primary education.
Yes, and then we went to Thebe Tech, and the boys went and did woodworking and other things, and the girls did extra classes up until grade 8 and 9. We all had to leave at 14, being so many of us, and all had to help. And so we all got a job and paid board in those days and helped the family. And then we grew up and we went to then the war came along and my husband and I joined up. I was married early and we joined up, didn't have any children, and so the ladies never went to overseas in that war, only our gallant doctors and nurses and dentists.
Let's come to those years in a minute. Just go back to your early years though. What are your memories of your father?
Oh, he was quite often ill but happy. He never ever had a row with our mother, as some of them do. Mum was in charge of the house and the children, and Dad went to work when he could, just in a labouring job. And one day I remember he said, "You boys, your mother called you for your lunch, and I've got the strap here. You're going to get it as you pass me." "Oh, Dad, you know you never hit us. And you won't hit us, Dad." He said, "I will today. I mean it." So anyone said, "No, Dad, you won't." So they nicked through the 4 boys at that stage, and he tapped one. And he said, "Oh, Dad, you tapped me." He said, "But it didn't hurt anyhow."
So he was a kind man. He was a kind and gentle.
Oh, he was gentle and nice. Yes, he was just really a lovely, lovely dad. Yeah. But never actually played cricket with all the boys, but he got all the things ready for them because he just didn't have the stamina to keep up with young kids.
And your own birth date, what was that, Thelma? When were you born?
17th of June, 1922.
17th of June, 1922.
I'm now 96.
96. And I should, for the record, just say that when I first met you this morning, you were doing an exercise class.
That's correct. Every Tuesday morning we have exercise class in the War Widows Complex.
Good on you. So those early days with a father who had been much affected by war, war cast a shadow after the end of hostilities for quite a while. He was never a well man. Were you aware of his decline in health and his gradual fading, his death?
Only as we got older we noticed, and that's how it was. And he was in and out of the Adelaide hospital. And the sad thing, Mother put him for a war pension and they wouldn't allow it, and she didn't know, and Legacy Club didn't tell her that she could reapply. However, she struggled on, and many, many years later, after we were growing up, a Legacy man said, oh, he said, you could have reapplied for that and got it all these years instead of being in Struggle Street. And Mother said, I was never told. So we were a bit sad about that. She wasn't given that information.
Indeed. Money was pretty tight, wasn't
it? Oh, very. It was just the end of the Depression.
Yes.
And no one, we were all poor in the same area, in Brompton and Hindmarsh and Bowden and all those working class areas. We all went to the Hindmarsh school and great teachers. And then there was a mission down the road and they had a hot lunch, soup every day, and you get an apple as you came out. But that wasn't, we never went every day. Mother used to do our sandwiches, but if the boys wanted to go down and have a hot soup lunch, they did, and get an apple, or if it was mandarin time, they'd hand out a mandarin each. So we thought we were wonderful.
Now, you said there were 12 children.
Yes.
What were you in terms of number? Which one?
Number four.
You were number four.
And we had a lovely sister who was a quadruple nursing sister. She was going to be a missionary. That's why she had to do the four certificates. And eventually she fell in love with the training college and wasn't allowed to go. You can't if you're engaged. They got engaged, so she wasn't allowed to go. And she always used to, when she rang her, say, hello, number four, number 12 here. Always.
That's lovely.
Dear Elaine.
You said she wasn't allowed to go. You mean go to war? What's this? You said she wasn't allowed to go. What did you mean?
To the mission field.
To the mission.
She wasn't allowed to be a missionary because you had to go as a single person and she'd just become engaged and it was a no-no. So
did this mean that you all, especially the older children, had to find jobs pretty soon?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. From 14, we all had to get a job to help the family finances. Even then, the milk bill was mother pay once a week, and that was a very heavy bill. And I remember my brother who was selling papers on the Port Road Hindmarsh at the corner of Worsley's Big Emporium, opposite the post office, and some of the people who'd give Sid tuppence, and it was a penny halfpenny newspaper, afternoon newspaper, and they'd say, oh, I'll keep the halfpenny, son, there you are, and others would wait for it because money was money in those days. And he'd bring his money home to Mum and said, here, Mum, said, no, you've worked for it, that's yours. He said, no, I'll keep enough for two comics, Ginger Megs and Crackers, I think the two were called. And Sid would read them, pass them around to all of us. And Mother would have only, she didn't want to take it, but she got the other money. That was the milk bill every week. So he was doing that from the age of about 12. He was pretty good with figures. And he turned, as he grew up, he went to the war, was a rat at Tobruk. He is now 97 years of age.
Your brother, yes.
And he lives in Alice Springs, and he spends 2 hours a day in the garden at 97, as fit as anything. And so hard work didn't hurt anyone.
So that's, I'm looking at the Australian War Memorial record here. That's your brother, Sidney George Kinsman.
Yes.
Born in 1920, so a couple of years older than you. And he served in the 2nd 48th.
Yep.
at Tobruk.
Yes.
What did
and El Alamein, and then at they got made prisoners of war from the Germans,
yes.
And they congratulated them for holding on for 8 months, being bombed day and night. And they handed them over to the Italians to be the prisoners of war of the Italians, because the Germans couldn't keep them there. They didn't have any room. And eventually, I said to my brother, were they cruel to you? And of course, it was compared to what happened to our wonderful men in Changi.
Yes.
It was like a Sunday school picnic. They worked in the rice fields. I didn't know Italy had any rice fields. But anyhow, they worked in the rice field. And he said the cruelest thing they did, they got them in a big circle one day. There wasn't a lot of them there. And they had a fire going in the middle, and the mail came, and they'd read out their names, and there was 2 Italians with guns, throw them in the fire. And our boys used to want to go and grab them out of the fire, but there was guns pointing at them, so they couldn't do it. That was the cruelest thing they could have done to anyone, taking their letters from home, which didn't always get through because the boats used to be bombed coming through. And anyhow, they escaped, 3 of them. There was a Kiwi man, a Victorian man, and my brother, and they walked for 11 nights. They hid in the day, walked for 11 nights into the Swiss Alps, and got safely into Switzerland.
This is an extraordinary story. So Sydney, in Alice Springs, you say,
yes,
to this
yes.
day, gardening. And
yes, 97.
And fit. And he was a POW. He'd survived Tobruk, survived El Alamein. He was captured.
In Tobruk.
And taken to Italy.
Yep.
And then he had this remarkable escape.
Yes.
What an incredible story.
And when they arrived in Switzerland, the guards couldn't believe them. They said, but you'd never have come over those Alps in the night. Sid said, we were desperate. He said, we're experienced mountaineers. We wouldn't even do it of a night. They never even had a torch. So they wore out their shoes and put the tops of the tied them on with the I think they tore strips off their shirts or something to tie these things so they wouldn't cut their feet on the, which they did. They all went there with bad feet. And they had to hide their uniforms and get into working man's clothes. So they went to this farm, and there was these couple of men, and Sid said he wanted his shoes, and he gave him his boots, and the man hugged the boots and cried. Leather, beautiful army leather boots. And my brother had his thin things that wore through within about 2 days of walking in the mountains. And Sid gave him another chappie's jacket and uniform, and had a thin shirt and a thin coat. But they were lucky to get away, so...
So what happened when they got to Switzerland?
Well, the guards couldn't believe that they interviewed the 3 of them separately, because they couldn't believe they'd climb over those mountains without equipment and without a torch and without food. And Sid used to call, they used to creep into any farmhouses and ask for help, and wouldn't steal until they were they always asked.
Yeah.
And it was the women who helped them, gave them a bit of food and a dry clothes, or put them by a fire because it was near the mountains and it was snowing. So.
And what happened in terms of the Red Cross or an escape route, a pathway back to Britain? What happened to him after
well,
that?
Well, finally, he got brought home in the Christmas. They arrived in December of 1944, and the war ended the next year. So they were repatriated home. They took some prisoners back to Switzerland, and they went to their places from there, and Sid and them were allowed to come. They brought them back home because the Women's Weekly interviewed them mixing a big Christmas pudding, and so they were home in time for Christmas 1944.
That's a remarkable story, truly remarkable story. While all that was happening, and letters were being burnt, and these
that
happened once, okay. What about you? Now, you left school?
Yes, and I worked at Alaska Ice Cream Factory. It was just around the corner.
Alaska Ice Cream Factory.
In those days, not Amscol. Amscol was there as well, but this was Alaska. And we worked there, and I worked there until I got married. And
were you making ice cream? What were you doing?
No, we were packing them. And filling up the Dixies.
Yes.
In what's name? And other people would dip ice creams into chocolate, and we'd wrap the Eskimo pies.
The chocolate-covered Eskimo pie.
Got it.
A wonderful.
You wouldn't remember that. You're too young.
No, my favourite ice cream. I love Eskimo pies.
Well, they were Alaska Eskimo pies.
They were the best.
Yeah, they were. They were wonderful.
So you got that job, and
then I got married from there.
Well, yes. Tell me now, how did you meet your husband?
His sister and I were great friends. We all went to the same school. My husband went to the same school.
Yes.
But he was 3 years older, so he never noticed me.
Right.
But as we got older, she introduced... Well, I knew him, so she said, I think he wants to take you out. I said, oh, does he? So anyhow, we arranged to meet at the Beehive Corner in Rundle Street and King William Street. And then we went to the pictures. And I think I said, am I what you expected? He said, oh, definitely. And so we went on and we got married quite young. Then we both joined the Air Force.
Now, this is Albert Frederick Zimmerman.
Correct.
Your husband. He enlisted in the Air Force, according to the records here, in 1942. You were only 20 and he was 23.
Yes.
And you'd been out on a few dates, and when did you get married? What year was that? When did you get married?
Well, it was 5 days before 1940.
Yes. 50. Okay. So off he went, enlisted, off he went to war.
Well, we both enlisted together,
and
on different days.
So
oh, yes. You're allowed to go if you're married if you didn't have children.
Oh, I see. So this was the Women's Auxiliary.
Women's Australian Auxiliary Air Force.
Yes.
WAFS.
WAFS, right. And where were you posted then?
Well, I went to Melbourne to learn to be a telephonist.
Yes.
And then back to Adelaide. They tried to keep you in your home state because they couldn't afford to keep giving you leave and you have to come back to another state. And it was they didn't have the manpower and they couldn't afford it.
Yes. So you learned to be a telephonist. Yes. And where were you posted then?
Back to Adelaide at 4STT, which was the exhibition building in North Terrace, Adelaide.
Any memories of those days? Was it a tough job?
Lovely, lovely friendships. And I had my special friend. We were friends for 62 years until she died. It was just a wonderful friendship. I was auntie to all her children, and she was auntie to my daughter.
Who was this?
Betty McMurtrie. She was Betty Huddy in those days. Just a very loyal, sweet and beautiful lady.
Lovely story.
62-year friendship.
And was it a frantic life being on the telephone exchange there?
It was always busy.
Yes.
And if the commanding officer put a call through, you dropped everything else and did his. He was number one, the hierarchy, but a very lovely man.
Lovely, lovely. I've seen a photograph here. The uniform really suited you. I think you loved it, didn't you?
Well, we were proud of it.
You look wonderful. And your husband, Albert, do you call him Albert?
Yeah, Alb.
Alb, okay.
Yeah.
Where was he while you were on the exchange here? What happened?
He was in Melbourne, and he did the course of a fitter and turner.
Yes.
And he wanted to be, they wanted to be air crew. And the sergeant said, you can't all be, we'll be air crew. He said, we've got to have ground staff. So he said, righto, you over there, you know. So my husband got to be ground staff. And then just when they finished their courses and were due to have a week's leave and told where they were going to be posted, an officer came in and spoke to the sergeant. And when he went out, he said, anyone done any cementing? So my husband put his hand up. His father had died when he was only 3 years of age. And so his uncle used to come and look after him and be the surrogate father. So he taught him how to help doing a bit of cementing. So then he said, anyone else? And chap said, I poured water while Dad mixed the cement one day. He said, over there. And someone else said, I took Dad out a cup of tea when he was cementing. He said, there's always one in a class over there. And he said, now I need 12. If I don't get another 9, he said, I'm going to go you, and you daren't not go when they pointed to you. So he got his 12. So the others went off, and these had to have a week learning, a quick week of learning, cementing, and very, very strong cement to get an aircraft down full of men and machinery. Right. So anyhow, they did that. Then they had their leave. Off they went, and then they were patching up airstrips, called them Island Hoppers. It was the Air Construction Corps. So off I went, going from with a group from island to island, putting them down. The planes would come over and drop all the troops. Gradually, they pushed the Japs back out of Australia.
So this is
out of the Philippines.
The yes. So this is the Pacific Campaign.
Yes, oh
and
yes.
It's building airstrips on the islands.
Now, patching them up. They'd already built, yep. but they had to patch them up so the planes could bring our troops in, so they could push the Japs further back.
I see the Japanese were bombing these strips.
Yeah, every night after they finished them. Sometimes they'd mishit them, and other times they wouldn't. And one night the sergeant said, well, get your B-tilly lamps out. He said, you've got 2 hours before the plane comes. And he said, it's on its way. So they had to, he said, crush all that and put it down first. Then they had to hammer it down and get it level. Then they had to put cement on, then dry cement on top of that, so that the planes could so it could dry quicker and the planes could land. It was a bit bumpy when they landed because it wasn't perfect, and the troops would all pile out, and after the boys had had a couple of days rest, they'd be flown to the next island.
So your husband Al, he was away for quite a while.
Oh, like most of them. Although he did come home on 4 days leave, and that's when I became pregnant. And so before the end of the war, I got discharged because I wasn't allowed to stay in, of course, if you were pregnant. So then I went back, and he had a mastoid operation. And they said, you can either take your chances, we'll fly you back to Australia. You've got 1 chance in 100 of surviving with the air, with your ear like that. Or we can do it here in the tent. You've got 1 in 10 flying him back to Australia, and 1 in 100 doing it here. I said, I'm staying here. Yeah. Who wouldn't? So anyhow, then he got discharged and fly back. Eventually.
And that was a lovely reunion, I'm sure.
It was wonderful. Yeah. And he had a little baby daughter to come home and greet. Diane, our only child.
Diane.
Yes.
And she was born in 1945.
And she's now 73 years of age.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Loved her father dearly.
That's beautiful. So he came back from the war. And he had was he well, or he'd got over this ear?
Oh,
trouble?
Yes, but he was never allowed to swim with that, but it didn't matter to him. He always swam. He went down the beach and still swam. But he always had this bad ear. But he was okay. Physically, he was quite good and used to go to the gymnasium and things like that, which not like today's gym. This was just once a week thing. A group of them would go and do a few exercises. And in his youth, he used to play cricket and football and just local district cricket. And then his chances when he came back were nil because of a little bit of off balance.
Yes.
So that was the end.
So there were the three of you. There was Al.
Yes, but we had a lot. Some of our two brothers and sisters came and lived with us because housing was hard to get, so they moved in with Al and I for a while, and that was all happy families.
Where was this? Where did you live?
We lived at Hindmarsh in Theberton.
You bought a house?
We bought a house at Woodville West, a war service home.
Yes.
And then we stayed there until Al died, sadly, at 56 of cancer.
Well, let's just go back a little bit. So you had this, the three of you as a happy family, and with members of your family joining you?
Oh, yes. There were so many of us. He said, I didn't just marry you, Thelma. I married the whole 12 of you. But he loved them dearly, and they loved him. And the younger ones, he was like their surrogate father, because our father died at 46, and Al was the eldest, and a bit older than my brother. And the little ones, 3 and 4, used to look up at him and just adored him.
So this was when you were living in a couple of addresses.
Yes, Theberton. We were living at Theberton at that stage, my mother's big house.
And then
she didn't know. No, she was just renting it. Of course, we're all poor in those days, and just getting over the depression.
And you lived at Hindmarsh as well?
Yes, then we went to Hindmarsh. When I got married, we moved in without Mum and Dad. You couldn't get a little house. We couldn't afford it anyhow.
And then you got your war service home then?
Yes, we did. And that was at Woodville West.
Wonderful.
Just off Trimmer Parade.
Thank you. What job did your husband have then in civilian life?
He didn't like to be inside, so he worked, as he did before the war, at Hallett's and King's Brickyards. Worked there for years, and then finally he found that that was too much, and he went to the public service, and he was in Weights and Measures.
So was he making bricks at his other place?
Oh, yes.
Then, please go on.
And then they'd have to go on night shift because they burnt for 24 hours. So some of them were there night time checking that the fires kept going. You couldn't let them go because you had to have the bricks at special temperatures. And he did that for quite a few years, then joined the public service and became an inspector with the Weights and Measures, going around to depots, checking the contents of the milk to make sure there was enough cream in it and things like that, hadn't been watered down and things like that. Often called into butcher shop, checking their scales and all sorts of things like that. They called it the Weights and Measures Department.
So this took us up through the 1940s into the 50s, and what were you doing in this time? Did you find a job?
Well, I was became a hairdresser, even though I was a mother, and ladies didn't work just quite after the war, but because they worked during the war, they kept on, so then I became a hairdresser, did it for 22 years. 42 years.
Wonderful.
Finished, I was about 70.
I should explain for people listening to our interview today that Thelma has beautifully coiffed white hair, and you have taken a lot of trouble with that. You look wonderful.
Thank you.
It's important to you to have your hair.
Well, you always keep yourself tidy, and a lady said on Saturday, "And what are you doing today?" I said, "I'm going down to have a perm. I do my own hair each week, but when I need a perm, I go down to this lady who's done me for 35 years. Thank you, Kate." And this lady said, "It doesn't look as if it needs doing." I said, "It took a long time to look like this because I wanted to go in to the 10th Battalion procession down King William Street with the Lord and Lady Marius. Genevieve and Martin Hess. So I was with them on Saturday, so I had to have my hair nice to be with the Lord and Lady Marius. Well,
they're friends of yours. They're friends of yours.
Yes, they are. Yes. Lovely people. Good. Very natural. Yeah. Walk around the streets of Adelaide meeting the people. He's just such a beautiful man.
I agree. And then Alb became ill. Al became sick. He developed cancer.
Yes, and we thought it was a hernia. Yeah. So we went and we had a specialist, and he was at the private part of Queen Elizabeth. And I don't mean to sound snooty about that, but I always believed in having health care, as my husband did. And just after that, it was diagnosed as cancer, and sadly, he died at 56.
That's a terrible time for you. And Diane lost her father when...
whom she was just adored.
And she was only, 30 or so then, I suppose. God. Yes,
I
that's
never
all right.
So young.
That is... Yeah. You have grandchildren?
He had one granddaughter, yes. Fontella. She was a journalist for 10 years at the Advertiser. And she is now 53. And... Ab lived to see her 10 years of age.
What's her surname, Fontella's surname?
Colef.
Yes, I remember seeing her name. It's a name, name you remember, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, Fontella. She was named after Fontella Bass, a French Creole singer, because her father, Malcolm Dick, was Mac Dick at Channel 9, set designer and decorator for many years, and played many instruments, so he had some records of... Fontella Bass, so he said they named her Samantha, and then he said, "Can we change it to Fontella?" Which they did.
Really?
So, yes.
That's clever. So, this entitled you to membership of the War Widows Guild, his death, because he'd been on active service overseas.
Yes.
And you joined the War Widows Guild immediately, did you?
I never heard of it, but they sent me a letter. So then I joined for, you know, almost just after Alf's death. But I'd never even heard of them. And so, and a lot of people today don't even know what they say. What do you mean, war widows? What are you talking about, you know? Then you have to explain that a returned serviceman, when they died, their wives became war widows. And then you put in for a war widows pension, which is better than the civilian ones because you get your medical, dental to a certain extent. You can't have implants, you have to pay for those, but they attend to your fillings and extractions. And they're absolutely wonderful to the war widows. DVAR, they're just wonderful.
And there's the companionship.
Absolutely. And I'm living in a war widows complex and we're all friends. We all help each other and just lovely. Like as this morning, exercise class, we have a meeting once a month. I man the training table after many other ladies have done it until they died. And I'm on the way out at 96, but I still can manage to do it.
Well, let's have a look back again. You and Alf and Diane had your house in Woodville.
Yes.
And you stayed there for some time after his death?
Yeah, we were there for many years. And my brother came to live with us and he stayed there till he went to Melbourne to train for an Anglican priest. And he'd come home every holidays and he'd say to Alf, "Hello, Daddy-o, great to be home." He said, "When you going back, John?" They had a good rapport together. It was just lovely.
You said you're an Anglican priest, but you were from a family of 12. I perhaps incorrectly assumed you were Catholic with a family
of
12.
No, Anglican.
Anglicans.
Yes, you'd think so, but there was not the pill in Mother's Day,
you see.
And they couldn't afford, I suppose, prevention. So baby every 15 months or 12 months or whatever.
And so the name of your brother who became a priest?
Kinsman. Father John Kinsman.
Father John Kinsman, yes.
Yes, he was around the district. Then he was 28 years at Gawler.
Yes.
Then came down and finished his terms at Colonel Light Gardens and retired from there. And then did many things. He was the out at Edinburgh Air Base, he was a warrant officer, just civilian warrant officer, because of his status as an Anglican priest. And until he turned 60, then they gave him his marching orders and they gave him a dinner. And John said, "Oh, well, I've used up my use-by date, so you're kicking me out." So, and it was all fun. Another time he went to, I've forgotten the name of a little island, and the governor was on leave and John took the Anzac Day service.
Yes.
And they told him after he did a good job.
I wanted to talk to you about Anzac Day because you know the Lord Mayor, you seem to know a lot of people of influence. Used you to march on Anzac Day?
I marched until last year.
Yes.
And that was the first time I sat on the dais along Key Willow Street next to the Lord Mayor's big, with all the big wigs there, you know. All the politicians and all that.
So just looking again, you told me you were born in 1922.
Two.
So your last march was 2016 or 17? So last year was 17.
I didn't march, no, 16.
16.
Yes.
That's pretty darn good.
I was 94.
Yes.
Not 95. Nearly 94.
Yes.
And I did march in 95. From 95 I stopped marching.
Yes.
I was a bit wobbly. Slow, wobbly, hard to see, hard to hear. And
so last year, up on the dais.
On the dais, yes.
And again next year, I hope.
Yes. If I'm still here, I'm on the way out, but if I'm still here, I'll be there.
Now, your husband died at the age of 56. You stayed at your house in Woodville for some...
For 9 years.
For another 9 years.
And then I bought a place at Glengarry.
Yes.
To be near my sister who was down at Brighton.
Right.
And then after 5 years, I put in for a war widow's cottage here, or unit, and I came out here and I lived in another one, and they had a couple of little steps into the bathroom, into the kitchen and dining room. So I had a fall one night, I was only half awake, and so I asked could I have one with all level floor space, And eventually this one came free, and after 13 years, I got it.
Well, I should explain again the setting. It's a magnificent room.
It's a beautiful...
High ceilings.
11-storey, yes. 11-room, single-storey mansion. Yes. And I'm fortunate enough to have a quarter of it. Four ladies live in, and we've got a lovely lounge, lovely kitchen, bathroom and bedroom. And so fortunate indeed. I'll die happy here.
Well, it's in a lovely part of town. Treeline Street and Rose Park. You can't do better than that, can you?
Just 5 minutes from the city. It's just wonderful. I'm grateful every day that I'm sharing this beautiful home. And as I said earlier, I'm going to die happy here.
Well, I think you've got plenty of life in you because you move so fast. And when I arrived today, you were doing the exercise class. Tell me about life here. What is a typical day like? What do you do?
Well, I have a fairly busy life. On Mondays, I meet some of my family, not every Monday, but especially on birthdays. 12 of us meet down at the Broadway at Glenelg, and we have lunch, all family members. And then that's that day. And Tuesday is exercise class. Sometimes if I have an appointment, I make it on a Tuesday. Wednesday, I work in the Magdalen Centre. Wednesday morning.
What do you do there?
Give food and clothing to the needy and the homeless. And that's till lunchtime. I'm working in the clothing store. And people come in with vouchers and they're allowed to have whatever they want for $35. And for that, a man could get jeans, shoes, two shirts or T-shirt and a fashion shirt.
Yes.
And shoes.
And, of course, today we mentioned this Melbourne Cup Day. You're going to have a bit of a celebration here today?
Well, actually, I'm not, no. They used to, but the ladies go out now to luncheons.
Ah, okay.
But I'm a bit old and wobbly for that. I still go out to lunch, but I'm always busy with my family.
Yes, now, Diane has children?
She has one daughter, Fontella.
Yes, Fontella.
She was a journalist for 10 years at the Advertiser. Then she went to uni and got a bachelor, and then she's been in the public service ever since. She's in the environment and in the fisheries and wildlife. And at one stage when she was posted to Tasmania, she had to take photos of the trees every 3 months, measure the girth every 3 months, and do other things there, and in the forestry department at that stage. So it's all combined with all the outdoor things, and she's part of that busy section.
You serve as an example to us in terms of your wonderful passion for life. What's the secret, do you think, of long life and health?
Well, I don't know. My mother lived to 98. She was fit and healthy, and she was always busy. She was fairly quick, never had a walking stick, until sadly, at 91, she had a stroke. And then the doctor said, you can no longer live alone. And she said, oh, well, if that's it. She had a little few tears. Then she said, oh, well, what's to be will be. So our dear sister Jean, who was today 95, took mother to her home for the last 7 years of mother's life.
Been wonderful talking to you. Just a couple of final thoughts. Is there anything in life that you really wished you had done and you haven't? Anything you feel
no,
you missed out on?
No, not especially. Had one trip overseas, but no.
Where
Australia's
did you go?
Wonderful.
Where did you go and what did you do?
My daughter and I, we went to UK and Paris, just London. We went down to Shakespeare's country.
Yes.
We went down there and seen all the lovely things there and went into the church. And we had a friend living there at the time. It was just wonderful. And I loved Paris. It was just so romantic and beautiful, the buildings. And, oh, it was just so gorgeous. However, Australia is home. No place like Australia. I love it.